Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. In the Washington, D.C. area, hundreds of hungry people receive food that may not look beautiful, but it is healthy and safe to eat. We will have more on this so-called ugly food later in the program. But first, tens of millions of years ago, an asteroid hit what is now the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. The event led to a global mass extinction that has been linked to the end of the dinosaurs. New research shows what that great disaster led to: a modern age of fish. Marcia James has more.
66 million years ago, the ocean was a different place. Sharks and octopus-like creatures were powerful. But scientist Elizabeth Seibert says there were other important species as well.
There were also many marine reptiles that were swimming around. And of course, there were fish. Absolutely, there were ray fin fish around. It's just that they weren't very dominant.
Ms. Seibert is a graduate student at the University of California, San Diego. She and her professor compared microfossil fish teeth and shark scales in sediment that dated before and after the mass death.
Basically, the deeper down you get, the older you get. So we looked at sediments from about 75 million years ago to about 45 million years ago, looking every 200,000 years in some cases, looking every 10,000 years in other cases.
Fossil evidence showed that the ratio of fish to shark changed sharply after the asteroid hit. Elizabeth Seibert explains.
We see that instead of having about equal number of shark fossils and fish fossils, we see that the fish fossils more than double, and that trend continues while the shark fossils stay approximately the same.
The study suggests that the mass extinction killed many animals at both the top and bottom of the ocean food chain. This permitted animals in the middle of the chain to increase their numbers. Those animals are the ray-finned fish that represent nearly all fish species today.
And they radiated into all of these newly vacated spots and possibly some new things that wouldn't have existed at all if the extinction hadn't happened.
Elizabeth Seibert says her next step is to go back to the microfossil record. She will try to learn from it how the fish dealt with other stresses in the ocean, like global warming. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Thank you. The United States Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that about a third of all food produced for human use is never eaten. In the United States, many fruits and vegetables are thrown away simply because of their less than perfect appearance. Some groups are working to find ways to use that food in other products or to make sure it reaches people who really need it. Bob Doty reports.
Every week, Elizabeth Bennett cuts about 230 kilograms of apples into small pieces. She begins working after her employees cut out the core and seeds and remove any imperfections. The workers are all women. Some have no permanent place to live. Others once spent time in jail. Ms. Bennett earned a master's degree in food anthropology from the University of London. Last November, she launched a company called Fruit Cycle. It uses the apples rejected by American stores to make small treats called fruit chips.
To date, we've rescued about 10,345 pounds of apples that would have otherwise gone to waste.
Matt Harsh grows apples. He brings the fruit he cannot sell to Ms. Bennett.
We grow 40 acres of vegetables and 40 acres of fruit, and of that 80 acres total, about 10% of it is usually blemished or marked in some way that we can't sell it through our regular markets. We just have to throw those things out.
Elizabeth Bennett sells the apple chips at small stores in and near Washington, D.C. She says she is talking with a national supermarket chain about selling the chips in its stores.
People seem to love it. Using local fruit that's picked at its peak really, I think, makes a difference. My goal is getting into more stores, which will help us rescue more apples or other food and hire more women, and then at the same time continuing to build awareness around food waste.
Another company transports food that grocery stores have rejected to hungry people.
Hey there!
Hi!
How you doing?
Great!
A group called Hungry Harvest brings fruits and vegetables to Brittany Meininger every Sunday. She signed up for the service a few months ago. Evan Lutz helped create the company in May after completing college.
So this one is a little bit oversized. This one has some scarring. You know, that doesn't affect the quality of the fruit. However, it just, you wouldn't see this in a grocery store. If this got sent to a grocery store, it'd get rejected and sent back. And so what we do is we take this stuff, we bag it up in nice variety bags, and deliver it to our customers' doors.
Mr. Lutz buys the vegetables and fruit at low prices from local farms and food distributors. He uses some of his profits to help hungry people.
For every bag we deliver to one of our customers, we donate a healthy meal to someone in need.
Brittany Meininger says she isn't concerned about the appearance of the food.
I was happy to be part of their mission. Anyway, you cook it, you puree it, so it's really not important how it looks.
More than 500 people receive food from Hungry Harvest. The company expects to reach 5,000 people within a year. I'm Bob Doty.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. 1 year ago this week, riots began in Ferguson, Missouri, after an unarmed black teenager was killed by a white police officer. Earlier this week, officials declared a state of emergency in the city after people who had gathered to mark the anniversary became violent. Monday night, police arrested more than 20 protesters after being hit by rocks and bottles. But within a few days, tensions between protesters and police had eased. Although there have been clashes, some people in the city are trying to show that there is much to like about Ferguson. They are angry that reporters have not shown that much of their community is peaceful.
They make it seem like everybody out here just starting chaos, acting like maniacs. They talk about people shooting, but they don't talk about the positive things that's out here going on.
Kenneth Wheat lives in Ferguson. He volunteers at the I Love Ferguson store. He says others are also beginning to become involved in efforts to improve the image of the city, including Jacqueline Damer. She also works at the store.
I volunteer because I want people to know about Ferguson and that we're a friendly, loving community, not at all what was portrayed.
Miss Damer, Mr. Wheat, and 22 others volunteer at the store. Profits are used to help the community. Miss Damer says the store has given a total of more than $100,000 to businesses affected by the rioting. On the one-year anniversary of the riots, reporters from other states have traveled to the city to write stories. People in Ferguson are worried that some of those reports will say that the city is a dangerous place where riots can begin at any time. They say that is not the truth about Ferguson. While Ferguson marks the one-year anniversary of rioting, Los Angeles, California is observing the 50-year anniversary of the Watts riots. Watts was, and still is, a poor neighborhood. Just as in Ferguson, riots began there when blacks clashed with white police officers who they believed were mistreating them. On August 11, 1965, white police officers stopped a black man and his mother who were riding in their car. The officers were accused of abusing them. Protests began quickly. They lasted for 6 days. Hundreds of buildings were damaged. 34 people were killed, and more than 1,000 people were injured. An exhibit at a local college shows pictures of the violence. Gregory Williams is the director of the Archives and Special Collections at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Mr. Williams says people in Watts and the Los Angeles Police Department have learned lessons from the clashes.
The reason that L.A. hasn't exploded again is because we're aware of the past. The police department's aware of the past.
People in the area say they have learned that violence does not help them improve their lives. Most people who live in Watts are still very poor, but their relations with the police force have improved. Officers who work in the neighborhood are black, Hispanic, and Asian, in addition to white. People in Watts hope relations with police will improve in other black neighborhoods in the United States as well. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter. And now, the VOA Learning English program, American Stories. The Western American city of San Francisco, California, suffered a huge earthquake on April 18, 1906. More than 3,000 people are known to have died. The true number of dead will never be known. 250,000 people lost their homes. Just a few hours after the terrible earthquake, a magazine named Collier's sent a telegraph message to the famous American writer Jack London. They asked Mr. London to go to San Francisco and report about what he saw. He arrived in the city only a few hours after the earthquake. The report he wrote is called The Story of an Eyewitness.
Not in history has a modern city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a few homes that were near the edge of the city. Its industrial area is gone. Its business area is gone. Its social and living areas are gone. The factories, great stores and newspaper buildings, the hotels, and the huge homes of the very rich are all gone. Within minutes of the earthquake, the fires began. Within an hour, a huge tower of smoke caused by the fires could be seen 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this huge fire moved in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. The earthquake had smashed all the modern inventions of a 20th century city. The streets were broken and filled with pieces of fallen walls. The telephone and telegraph systems were broken, and the great water pipes had burst. All inventions and safety plans of man had been destroyed by 30 seconds of movement by the earth. By Wednesday afternoon, only 12 hours after the earthquake, half the heart of the city was gone. I watched the huge fire. It was very calm. There was no wind. Yet, from every side, wind was pouring in upon the city. East, west, north, and south, strong winds were blowing upon the dying city. The heated air made a huge wind that pulled air into the fire, rising into the atmosphere. Day and night, the calm continued, and yet, near the flames, the wind was often as strong as a storm.
There was no water to fight the fire. Firefighters decided to use explosives to destroy buildings in its path. They hoped this would create a block to slow or stop the fire. Building after building was destroyed. And still the great fires continued. Jack London told how people tried to save some of their possessions from the fire.
Wednesday night, the whole city crashed and roared into ruin, yet the city was quiet. There were no crowds. There was no shouting and yelling. There was no disorder. I passed Wednesday night in the path of the fire. In all those terrible hours, I saw not one woman who cried, not one man who was excited, not one person who caused trouble. Throughout the night, tens of thousands of homeless ones fled the fire. Some were wrapped in blankets. Others carried bedding and dear household treasures. Many of the poor left their homes with everything they could carry. Many of their loads were extremely heavy. Throughout the night, they dropped items they could no longer hold. They left on the street clothing and treasures they had carried for miles. Many carried large boxes called trunks. They held on to these the longest. It was a hard night, and the hills of San Francisco are steep, and up these hills, mile after mile, were the trunks dragged. Many a strong man broke his heart that night. Before the march of the fire were soldiers. Their job was to keep the people moving away from the fire. The extremely tired people would arise and struggle up the steep hills, pausing from weakness every 5 or 10 feet. Often, after reaching the top of a heartbreaking hill, they would find the fire was moving at them from a different direction. After working hour after hour through the night to save part of their lives, thousands were forced to leave their trunks and flee. At night, I walked down through the very heart of the city. I walked through mile after mile of beautiful buildings. Here was no fire. All was in perfect order. The police patrolled the streets, and yet it was all doomed, all of it. There was no water. The explosives were almost used up, and two huge fires were coming toward this part of the city from different directions. 4 hours later, I walked through this same part of the city. Everything still stood as before, and yet there was a change. A rain of ashes was falling. The police had been withdrawn. There were no firemen, no fire engines, and no men using explosives. I stood at the corner of Kearney and Market Streets in the very heart of San Francisco. Nothing could be done. Nothing could be saved. The surrender was complete. It was impossible to guess where the fire would move next. In the early evening, I passed through Union Square. It was packed with refugees. Thousands of them had gone to bed on the grass. Government tents had been set up, food was being cooked, and the refugees were lining up for free meals. Late that night, I passed Union Square again. Three sides of the square were in flames. The square with mountains of trunks was deserted. The troops, refugees, and all had retreated. The next morning, I sat in front of a home on San Francisco's famous Nob Hill. With me sat Japanese, Italians, Chinese, and Negroes. All about were the huge homes of the very rich. To the east and south of us were advancing two huge walls of fire. I went inside one house and talked to the owner. He smiled and said the earthquake had destroyed everything he owned. All he had left was his beautiful house. He looked at me and said, "The fire will be here in 15 minutes." Outside the house, the troops were falling back and forcing the refugees ahead of them. From every side came the roaring of flames, the crashing of walls, and the sound of explosives. Day was trying to dawn through the heavy smoke. A sickly light was creeping over the face of things. When the sun broke through the smoke, it was blood red and small. The smoke changed color from red to rose to purple. I walked past the broken dome of the City Hall building. This part of the city was already a waste of smoking ruins. Here and there through the smoke came a few men and women. It was like the meeting of a few survivors the day after the world ended.
The huge fires continued to burn on. Nothing could stop them. Mr. London walked from place to place in the city, watching the huge fires destroy the city. Nothing could be done to halt the firestorm. In the end, the fire went out by itself because there was nothing left to burn. Jack London finishes his story.
All day Thursday and all Thursday night, all day Friday and Friday night, the flames raged on. Friday night saw the huge fires finally conquered, but not before the fires had swept 3/4 of a mile of docks and storehouses on the waterfront. San Francisco at the present time is like the center of a volcano. Around this volcano are tens of thousands of refugees. All the surrounding cities and towns are jammed with the homeless ones. The refugees were carried free by the railroads to any place they wish to go. It is said that more than 100,000 people have left the peninsula on which San Francisco stood. The government has control of the situation, and thanks to the immediate relief given by the whole United States, there is no lack of food. The bankers and businessmen have already begun making the necessary plans to rebuild this once beautiful city of San Francisco.
The Story of an Eyewitness was written by Jack London and adapted by Paul Thompson. It was published in Collier's Magazine, May 5, 1906. Your narrator was Doug Johnson.